Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Up Jumped the Devil, The Real Life of Robert Johnson, by Bruce Conforth and Gail Dean Wardlow, read by Leon Nixon. Introduction. Robert Johnson has occupied a unique place in the American musical psyche for almost 60 years. Until 1959, he was an interesting bluesman only to those few 78 RPM record collectors who were lucky enough to find one of his old recordings. But all that changed when Samuel Charters published his landmark book, The Country Blues, the first scholarly text devoted solely to the blues. Of Robert Johnson, Charters admitted, almost nothing is known about his life. That sentence is still true today. Johnson is the subject of the most famous myth about the history of the blues. He allegedly sold his soul at the crossroads in exchange for his incredible talent, and this deal led to his tragic death at age 27. This notion can be recited by almost everyone who has heard of him. But the actual story of his life remains obscure, save for a few inaccurate anecdotes. Charters claimed, incorrectly, that Robert was poisoned by his common-law wife in San Antonio, Texas, shortly after finishing his last recording session. He added the apocryphal anecdote that some of his recordings were done in a pool hall and were broken during a billiard ball fight. He interpreted Robert's lyrics in a sensational manner. "The finest of Robert Johnson's blues," he wrote, "have a brooding sense of torment and despair. The blues has become a personified figure of despondency. His singing becomes so disturbed it is almost impossible to understand the words." Charters was well-intentioned. But by publishing these words, he inadvertently assisted in the creation of a mythic Robert Johnson, with little relation to the real musician. Robert's music was re-released for the first time in 1959 on the companion album to Charters' book, which included Preaching Blues. Then, in 1961, Columbia released the album King of the Delta Blues Singers, finally giving the public wide access to his recordings. Producer Frank Driggs, in the liner notes to the album, drew upon Charters' book and the work of British blues scholar Paul Oliver. He admitted how little was known about Robert or his life. "Robert Johnson is little, very little, more than a name on aging index cards and a few dusty master records in the files of a phonograph company that no longer exists. Efforts on the part of the world's foremost blues research specialist to trace Johnson's career and substantiate details of his life have provided only meager information." But he added to Robert's mythic proportions with erroneous information. He was already a legend in 1938 when John Hammond was planning his Spirituals to Swing concert for presentation in Carnegie Hall. Johnson's recordings became collector's items almost as soon as they were released. Until his recording debut, Johnson had seldom, if ever, been away from the plantation in Robinsonville, Mississippi, where he was born and raised. It was obvious he wanted to get away, but never could. The album was produced largely through the instigation of the noted producer John Henry Hammond II, who had championed Johnson's work as early as the 1930s. King of the Delta Blues Singers was a landmark for several important reasons. It made Robert's music available to a new generation and audience, mostly young whites who were involved in the folk music revival. It boldly proclaimed Robert to be the king of the Delta blues singers. There was no one better. As the first major label reissue of any of the guitar-oriented country blues artists from the 1920s or 1930s, there was no other music to compare it to. Robert Johnson was it, the new generation's first experience in hearing the Delta blues. And it strongly influenced such future trendsetters as a young Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, and Keith Richards. They became Robert Johnson proselytizers. That release created new interest in all things Robert Johnson. His legacy and life were already being researched by scholars similar in age to or slightly younger than Charters, such as Mac McCormick and co-author Gail Dean Wardlow. But this release coincided with the launching of the blues revival. It sent young record collectors and fans seeking out bluesmen who recorded in the 1920s and 30s, and in the process they found Son House, Skip James, and others who actually knew Robert. Then, in 1968, Gail Dean made a historical discovery, locating Robert's death certificate. He also conducted a number of interviews in the 1960s with people who knew Robert personally, providing the first factual information about his life. In 1970, Columbia issued a second volume of Robert's songs with only three brief paragraphs of liner note information. There, blues writer Pete Welding maintained and added to Robert's myth by proclaiming, "Nor the blues are so apocalyptic in their life view. They are shot through with dark foreboding and almost total disenchantment with the human condition, and besetting mindless terrors that taunted all his days and nights. His songs are the diary of a wanderer through the tangle of the black underworld, the chronicle of a sensitive black Orpheus in his journey along the labyrinth path of the human psyche. In his songs, one hears the impassioned, unheeded cries of a man, rootless and purposeless. The acrid stench of evil burns ever in his mind." In 1973, Mac McCormick, a folklorist from Houston, Texas, who had already revived the career of Sam Lightnin' Hopkins, located Robert's half-sister, Carrie Harris Thompson. She showed him two photos of Robert. One was the now-famous Hooks Brothers studio portrait, and the other, unpublished and supposedly still in McCormick's collection, was a photo of Robert, his half-sister Carrie, and her son Louis in his Navy uniform. Finding Carrie launched McCormick into a decades-long search for additional factual information. Eventually, he found the man who had accidentally murdered the bluesman. McCormick planned to use his information to write a definitive book about Johnson, tentatively titled Biography of a Phantom. But the book never happened. Sam Charters re-entered the Robert Johnson universe in 1973 with a new book simply titled Robert Johnson. Charters used Robert's death certificate, found by Gail Dean, to focus on his story. He questioned Robert's birthplace as listed on the certificate and argued that Robert had to have been born in the Delta, since Hazelhurst is south of Jackson, about 35 miles out of it on Route 51 in Copiah County, and everybody else who knew Robert had always said he was from the Delta, north of Jackson in Tunica County. Charters also relied on recollections of Robert's sometime traveling partner, Johnny Shines, providing some insights into Johnson's personality and musical ability. But Shines provided little actual information about his life. The storyline was still missing. That same year, Bruce Cook published Listen to the Blues, describing Robert's importance to blues music and American culture. If Robert Johnson had not existed, they would have had to invent him. He is the most potent legend in all the blues, that of the gifted young artist, driven by his hunger for life and his passion for music to excesses that killed him at the age of 24. He is the Shelley, Keats, and Rimbaud of the blues, all rolled into one. If any bluesman is assured of immortality, it is this little drifter with a guitar who may never have left the South. Actually, Robert was accidentally murdered when he was 27 years old, not 24. But misinformation was not Cook's only problem. His analysis is preterite, romantic hyperbole. It articulated one of the quintessential American myths. The gifted drifter, driven by his hunger for life. The individual versus society and convention. Cook's comparison to Shelley, Keats, and Rambo furthered the image of a bright light burning itself out. When Memphis blues researcher Stephen C. Levere began tracing Robert's life, he used McCormick's lead to locate Robert's half-sister, Carrie Harris Thompson. In 1973, he convinced her to make a contractual agreement to assign him 50% of all royalties and other monies generated by his overseeing Robert's material. Levere became, in essence, the overseer of Robert's life, music, and photos for the next several decades, fiercely protecting his own interests. In 1982, using information that Mac McCormick shared with him, Peter Guralnick published Searching for Robert Johnson in Living Blues magazine. But this biography contained little hard data. Guralnick tried to document Robert's life, but his account is more widely known for one single sentence. Son House was convinced that Robert Johnson had sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads, and undoubtedly, as Johnny Shines says, others were too. There is no evidence, however, that House ever made such a statement. The myth that had been a rumor now seemed to be fact. Guralnick expanded his article into a book, released in 1989 under the same title, and that same year, Rolling Stone magazine published the first photo of Robert. 1 year later, Living Blues magazine dedicated an entire issue to the death of Robert Johnson, his legend, crossroads, and hoodoo myths and more. Using interviews from many of Robert's contemporaries, it attempted to produce a factual understanding of the man and his life. In 1991, Sony Music released a 2-CD set of Johnson's recordings, the complete recordings. It marked the first time that all of Robert's known recordings, including alternate takes, were issued in one package. Producer Lawrence Cohn, a former head of Epic Records, which was now part of Sony Music, had led the effort to create a Roots Music reissue program. But Sony kept refusing. After several years of persuasion, they finally relented and approved the project. Cohn decided that Robert Johnson would be his first release. Sony expected the box set to sell no more than 10,000 copies over a 5-year period and ran an initial pressing of 4,000. Immediately, they were shocked. The set sold hundreds of thousands of copies in the first several weeks, and today has sold more than 50 million copies in the United States alone. It also won a Grammy Award. The accompanying booklet by Levere provided arguably the most complete information about Robert's life at that time. But it was still factually incomplete, because it did not focus on certain periods of his life, Memphis, for example. It also provided erroneous information about persons in Robert's life. The most glaring errors concern guitarist Ike Zimmerman and his role in Robert's musical development. Levere's work was good, but far from complete. In 1992, Sony Films released the British documentary, The Search for Robert Johnson, featuring blues guitarist and singer and Johnson disciple John Paul Hammond. The film introduced the world to Robert's former girlfriends and his boyhood pals and used informants like Gail Dean and McCormick. In 1996, Gail Dean found the backside of Johnson's death certificate and published its contents in Guitar Player magazine. 2 years later, he challenged the Crossroads myth in his book, Chasing That Devil Music. In 2003, Barry Lee Pearson and Bill McCulloch published Robert Johnson, Lost and Found. 1 year later, Elijah Wald's Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues, was released. While both are stellar books, neither claimed to be a biography of Robert. Pearson and McCulloch's work analyzed the genesis of myths surrounding his life. They claim that these were created by contemporary popular culture, stereotyping, and a fascination with reconstructing history. Wald examined the myths surrounding Robert's life, too, and tried to separate him from them. The closest written biography produced in recent years is Crossroads, The Life and Afterlife of Blues Legend Robert Johnson, by Tom Graves, which was published in 2008. LeVere claimed that Crossroads contained less hyperbole and more factual information about Johnson than any other book. But Graves' writings fell far short of LeVere's claim. Fewer than 30 pages contained information about Robert's life, and much of that was erroneous. Sony Records, who owned Johnson's recordings, recognized his strong marketability and decided to capitalize on his centennial year by releasing a special boxed set, the 2011 Robert Johnson, The Complete Original Masters Centennial Edition. It was marketed as the ultimate collector's vinyl piece. It recreated the historic look and feel of the original dozen 10-inch 78 RPM discs that were sold to record buyers in the 1930s. The limited edition sets were individually numbered from 1 to 1,000, housed in a lavish 10-inch album book. Each vinyl disc played at 45 RPM, and the set also reproduced the original record labels. Music historian Ted Gioia wrote a 1,500-word essay, and LeVere contributed a 5-page new biography. Robert's name and image were spawning many concerts, tributes, trinkets, and gigaws, including computer flash drives, guitar picks, and even a limited edition Robert Johnson Hellhound on My Ale beer. Manufactured by Dogfish Head Brewery, it bore the claim to accentuate and magnify the citrusy notes of the centennial hops, and as a shout-out to Robert Johnson's mentor, Blind Lemon Jefferson, we added dry lemon peel and flesh to the whirlpool. There is no evidence that Jefferson ever mentored Robert, but such factual information is unimportant when you're celebrating the birthday of a myth. No book before this one has included all of the reminiscences of Johnson by the people who knew him personally. After more than 50 years of researching Robert's life and performing his music, we decided to correct that omission and bring together those resources in our comprehensive biography. We meticulously researched every article, book, video, or film by any author or producer, from academic scholar to lay blues fan. We transcribed every quote by anyone who ever knew Robert, and we grounded this all with quotations from our own research and every other resource we could find. Every census record, city directory, marriage license, funeral notice, and newspaper article was studied and referenced. Herein, you will find memories of Robert from his stepfamily, boyhood friends, neighbors, fellow musicians, girlfriends, and other acquaintances. Everyone who ever committed a personal recollection to tape, page, or film. The quotations have been lightly edited for clarity. These sources helped us create a timeline of Johnson's life. What we produced is a book based not on conjecture about Robert Johnson, but on first-person accounts of who he actually was. By doing so, we hope to free Johnson from being the sign and myth that blues fans created and return him to his human particulars. Not only do we reveal Robert's real story, but also where other accounts were in error. Basically, we discovered that everything we and everyone else believed or thought about Robert Johnson was wrong in some respects. At this point, whatever remains unknown about Robert Johnson will probably remain unknown forever. Although this will almost certainly not be the last book about him, the possibility of any new revelations surfacing seems extremely remote. His story, a human story of suffering and joy, extreme highs and devastating lows, has finally been told. 1. Robert Johnson is in town. The summer of 1936, Robert Johnson stood in front of Walker's General Store and gas station adjoining the Martinsville train depot. He put down his bag, made of blue and white bed ticking and packed full of clothes, at least one notebook, and other belongings, and began playing his guitar. He was there to advertise his nighttime performance at O'Malley's, a bootleg house not far from the old Damascus Church, just north of neighboring Hazelhurst city limits, up the railroad tracks on the east side of old Highway 51. Hazelhurst was a town of about 3,000 souls, sitting 35 miles south of Jackson, Mississippi. Robert had been born in Hazelhurst 25 years earlier. And now he was there to play his blues at one of the many juke joints he frequented throughout the area. A slight 5'8", 140 pounds, Robert was well known for more than just his music. Robert had already gotten one local girl pregnant, Virgie Jane Smith, and the men in and around Hazelhurst wanted to make sure that was not going to happen to their daughters. Rosa Redmond was 11 years old that year. Later, a short, plump history teacher, she lived most of her life on the old Mangold plantation near both the house where Robert was born and O'Malley's Juke. She recalled that Robert's presence would create a certain stir among the residents. People would know when Robert was in town. The men would let people know, and if they saw him coming up the road, our mothers would make all the girls go inside. It was okay for our older brothers, uncles, or fathers to go see him play and get drunk, but it was off limits to us girls. They'd keep us inside and locked up. His blues was the devil's music and could only lead to sin. Throughout the Delta region and beyond, Robert's rambling had left a trail of drunken men and broken-hearted women. Whether he was playing a juke like O'Malley's, a picnic, or a party, Robert was always looking for a woman to satisfy his needs, financially or sexually. His songs were often a tool to seduce some woman he took a fancy to, and the human remnants he left behind were well known to locals. He even bragged about his conquests in one of his songs, Traveling Riverside Blues. I got women's in Vicksburg, clean on to Tennessee, but my Friars Point rider now hops all over me. Robert Johnson was using his guitar abilities to forge the transition from the older blues of Charlie Patton, Henry, Ragtime, Texas, Thomas, Lead Belly, or even Son House, to the more modern approach and sounds of Muddy Waters and the post-war blues players. He played blues, pop tunes, jazz, and ragtime, started to popularize the use of guitar riffs as signature elements of a song, and was the first to use a boogie beat for his rhythm accompaniment, copying the driving, rhythmic bass that barrel house pianists played with their left hand. His playing helped move blues guitar fretting out of the first position and into the use of the entirety of the fretboard, opening musical possibilities that had previously been reserved for jazz guitarists. He was a dancer and harmonica player in ways that surprised his companions, and he used all his entertainment talents as vehicles to further his quest for fame and freedom from the burdens of sharecropping and even perhaps from the Jim Crow racism of the South. Yet, in spite of his considerable talents, Robert displayed an untrusting and insecure personality. He refused to let you pay too close attention to how he was playing, turning his back on you or stopping his playing completely if you thought you were watching him too closely. But Robert also had an unrelenting desire for a good time, and his personal exploits would eventually lead to myth and speculation. He did little to make his world clear, for he refused to speak about his family and life, and he never, if he ever knew about them, did anything to either validate or disavow the ideas about him that circulated among his listeners and acquaintances. He was a chameleon who was perhaps on his own search for his true identity. By the time Rosa Redmond saw him, Robert's rambling had become both his main way of traveling from one musical job to the next and his way to satisfy his need to just get up and go. His travels on both sides of the Mississippi River took him on circuitous journeys throughout Mississippi and parts of Louisiana and Arkansas. He followed Highway 1, which ran alongside the Mississippi River, Highways 61 and 49, which went north and south through the center of the Delta, and Highway 82, which ran east and west. Robert found places to play and sing in Greenwood, Itobina, Moorhead, where the Southern crossed the Dog, Indianola, Holly Ridge, Leland, and Greenville, all located on Highway 82. From Greenville, Robert traveled north on Highway 1, stopping at Winterville, Lamont, Beulah, Rosedale, Gunnison, Sherrard, and then into Clarksdale. From Clarksdale, he had several options. He could continue north on Highway 61 and stop at Jonestown, with a detour west to Friars Point. Lula, one-time home of Charlie Patton, Tunica, Robinsonville, where his mother lived, Walls, and then his Memphis home. Memphis was where he spent his seminal childhood years, the home of the family he considered his true kin, headed by Charles Dodds Spencer, his mother's ex-husband. He would go back there as often as he could throughout his life. From Memphis, he could easily cross into Arkansas to reach West Memphis with its freewheeling base of jukes and party houses, then go to Marianna, Helena, and West Helena, wide open towns for black blues singers, which Robert could also reach via the Friars Point Ferry. If he went south from Clarksdale on Highway 61, he hit Alligator, Shelby, Mound Bayou, Marigold, Cleveland, and Shaw. Conversely, if he headed south on Highway 49 west, he stopped at Tutwiler, Drew, and Ruleville. Highway 49 East took him to Minter City, Greenwood, Chula, Yazoo City, Bentonia, where Skip James had lived and played, and finally into Jackson. From Jackson South on Highway 51, Robert stopped at Crystal Springs, home of Tommy Johnson, Hazelhurst, where his Aunt Clara lived, Beauregard and Wesson, and from there to Bogalusa, Louisiana, and over to Gulfport, Mississippi. Of the locations Robert frequented, Friars Point was particularly important. A ferry ran between there and Arkansas. Mississippi was still a dry state, even after Prohibition ended in 1933. So liquor was transported into Friars Point.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?